Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'll put some context around the numbers, perspective around the politics, clarity around the choices facing us in South Africa. Welcome, I'm Jeremy Mags. Coming up on the program, contractors warn that government payment delays are strangling South Africa's construction sector. Cape Town weighs an Airbnb crackdown as short-term rentals clash with housing affordability. South African households are under increasing pressure as financial stress now reshapes spending and borrowing completely. And from Karoo soil to global markets, the farmer is betting that pistachios could become South Africa's next billion-rand crop. It's Friday, the 13th of March. South Africa's construction sector says late payments are choking the life out of the industry. Contractors warning that projects are increasingly being financed out of their own pockets as payment cycles stretch well beyond the legally required 30 days, in some cases reaching 75 or more. Now, with razor-thin margins, a shrinking pool of major contractors, rising legal complexity in project contracts, and growing competition from international firms, industry leaders say the sector is under intense strain, just as government is pushing a massive infrastructure drive. Let's discuss this in a little more detail. I'm in conversation now with Ewan Massey, Director at Construction Law Specialists, MDA Attorneys. Ewan, welcome to you. And let's start with the core issue. How serious have payment delays become in the sector right now?
Thanks, Jeremy. Our business, obviously, we represent a number of major contractors in this sector, and we're at the coalface of a number of these particular payment issues. It's a real problem, Jeremy. There's legislation in place, but unfortunately, particularly in the public sector, there's large non-compliance with the legislation. And contractors are really left to their own devices to collect money and to be innovative in doing that. So it's a real issue. And one which is having a profound impact, particularly on the what I'd call the sort of smaller sized contractors, where they're unable to finance these larger projects for a prolonged period of time.
Ewan, I want to talk about consequence in just a moment, but those payment cycles, as I referenced, 60, maybe even 75 days or more. Do you have a specific reason as to why this is happening?
I just think it's largely incompetence, Jeremy, to be honest with you. It's the administration of payments in a number of government departments just doesn't take place within these periods of time.
So for contractors, and particularly smaller ones, as you referenced, and operating on very thin margins, maybe just explain to me what a delay like this actually means in practical terms.
So what it means is that whilst you're busy with the project that you're executing, you can't buy materials, you can't pay your subcontractors, you can't pay your labor in some instances, and that brings these projects to a grinding halt. And you only need to take a look around in most of our major cities, Jeremy, to see projects which have been running, never mind years, decades. We need to look, I don't know if you're based in Johannesburg, Jeremy, I presume you are, but we only need to look at the BRT here in Johannesburg. It's been built for well over a decade. It still isn't finished.
If that's the case, do you think that the delays could impact on safety and quality?
Yes. I think that most contractors would not compromise safety. There are safety issues, as we've seen recently, but most certainly on quality. When people aren't paid, the quality does drop off. That could be a real consequence of late payment.
And some in the industry say effectively that contractors are effectively financing public infrastructure projects themselves. That's probably a fair description, but unacceptable, you would suggest.
Yes, completely unacceptable. Most contracting businesses tender in very competitive markets. As you said in the introduction, they have very low margins. And it's certainly not a reward at those margins to finance these projects the way they have to and they're being required to.
So, Ewan, if payments are this unreliable and patently nothing is getting better here, why are contractors still bidding for these projects?
So many of the contractors, obviously, their business is contracting and they contract both in the public and private sector. So there are still projects which are, you know, it's not all projects which are subject to these extensive delays, and there's still good margins to be made on certain projects. So if you are a contracting business and you have several projects, you're making some money on some and losing on others, and hopefully in the balance, everything's going to be okay.
You mentioned the rise of something called an EPC contract, which, as I understand it, shifts more risk onto the contractors themselves. What is that? Why? And how is it changing the industry?
Yes, Jeremy. So EPC stands for Engineer, Procure and Construct. And essentially what that means is that a contracting organization is appointed to do everything. So there's a concept which the employer needs. I require a water treatment plant, or I require a power station, and I want you to build it for me. Please go away, design it, engineer it, procure the entire thing, construct it, and, you know, essentially give me the keys to the front door when you're done, and it must work. It's an onerous contracting strategy, but one which is very effective, and one which I think is found favor for a number of reasons. Firstly, it's bankable. So for private investors, particularly in the renewable energy space, for example, where money is being lent by banks to build wind farms and solar farms, it's a very good contracting strategy. But it's also finding favor in government circles because it transfers much of the risk onto the contractors. Now, it's not a matter of that risk being transferred unfairly, but more a learning curve for the local contractors to go through to adapt to this kind of contracting model to ensure that they adequately price for the unforeseen risk that they are taking on. And what we've seen that a number of contractors, particularly in the renewable energy space, have underestimated that risk with fairly severe consequences.
Let me move on to another issue, and that's the growing presence, Ewan, of international contractors winning major projects. Are local firms now being crowded out?
To a degree, yes, Jeremy. There's increased international competition, particularly from China, but also from other countries, from Europe, from India. And competition is good, but I think that some of the key projects which are being let at the moment, there is definitely a preference from government in particular to look abroad as opposed to investigating what's available locally. And if we don't have the expertise locally, to try and put in place plans to grow that expertise and make sure that we have it. There are several examples here. Some of the key projects and contracts for the Stanrail N2 upgrades have gone to foreign firms. And also the new generation versus transmission projects, where the transmission lines are being constructed by the new company that's been formed by Eskom. A lot of that work is earmarked to go to international contractors.
Let me end with this. If government, Ewan, is serious about its infrastructure pipeline, and one hopes that it is there a specific reform or reforms needed around payment and contracting that might just actually result in some kind of stabilization?
Yes, I think the answer, Jeremy, was actually put up a number of years ago by the Construction Industry Development Board, where they published a set of proposed regulations called the Prompt Payment Regulations, which provided for regulated payments, payment terms, and if payment was not made, there was a very quick dispute resolution mechanism which could be enforced by contractors to secure payment. And something along those lines would need to be introduced. We've seen it in a number of other countries, and it works with great success. So in the UK, in Australia, and many other countries around the world, they have similar regulations. And I think we need something like that here locally.
Ewan Massey, Director of Construction Law Specialists, MDA Attorneys, thank you very much.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Let's move on to property now, and the market in Cape Town is facing a growing clash between tourism and housing. Now, the city, and here's the background, has seen an explosion in short-term rentals through platforms like Airbnb. But what's really intensifying this debate is the claim that around 70% of residential units in Cape Town CBD are either hotel managed or listed on Airbnb. At the same time, the city is facing a severe shortage of long-term rental housing. That gap prompting calls for a crackdown, with the city, I understand, considering new bylaws that could treat many short-term rentals as commercial operations. What does that mean? Well, it could potentially double the municipal rates they pay. Someone with a view on this, and he's been on the program before, Grant Smee, Chief Executive Officer, Only Realty. Grant, welcome back. Let's start with the headline number. 70%, as I say, of residential units in the city CBD used for Airbnb or hotel style letting. If that's accurate, and you can test the number if you want to, has the housing market effectively, in your opinion, been hollowed out for ordinary residents?
Absolutely. I think the number is about 26,000 units on Airbnb currently. That excludes other platforms like Booking.com and Athestay and Lacoslaw. So the number must be much higher. And what that's done is removed a lot of units from the long-term rental market, therefore reducing supply and increasing rental amounts, and then also increased prices massively, not only because of speculation around Airbnb, but also because of limited supply in the market.
And how severe is the shortage of rentals in Cape Town generally for people?
Well, I think if you just take what's happening on the ground, there are queues of people that are joining viewings to get into properties. We're hearing numbers of 20 or 30 people at a time seeing properties. So I think what we're seeing on the ground is maybe not translating accurately in writing, but it really is severe, and there are massive shortages, particularly during the summer period.
Now, the median household income, and again, test my figures if I've got them wrong, in Cape Town, around 14,000, 15,000 Rand a month. A basic Airbnb studio is between 36,000 and 40,000 Rand a month. Has the short-term rental boom then actually priced locals out of their own city centre completely?
So I think that 36 to 40,000 Rand for a studio flat is at 100% occupancy, which is not entirely accurate. But I think, you know, if we're still running at about 25,000 Rand on average for a short-term Airbnb unit, then that is a high number. I think, you know, we do need to consider that because of the massive speculation around Airbnb, there definitely has been a reduction of units available to people that are affordable units. And that's then again pushed prices up. So it definitely has passed people out of pockets of the city, in particular the Greenpoint, Seapoint and Atlantic Seaboard, and then again parts of the city. There are pockets that do sort of maintain good value and are places that people can live, but again, that's it is definitely limited supply there.
There's a counterpoint as well, of course, is that property investors will argue they are simply responding to market demand, but weigh that up against perhaps a social responsibility that you have to exercise when housing supply is constrained. It is a difficult balance to achieve, is it not?
Yeah, look, I wouldn't want to be in the city's shoes at the moment to try and make that balance. They are obviously investing heavily in infrastructure, economic hubs outside of the city, as well as transport. So they're making every effort to offset the imbalance at the moment. But I also do see the investor side, where they invested previously, sometimes years ago, have taken the brunt of maybe negative sentiment and then now benefiting from Airbnb investment. So there is that balancing act you've got to take into consideration. But as usual, in particular in coastal city, there is definitely a limited supply of housing, accessible housing in Cape Town.
And talking about that balance then, as I understand it, cities like Barcelona, New York, Amsterdam have imposed strict caps on Airbnb rentals. Is there a case then that Cape Town has maybe waited too long to start any kind of regulation?
So, yeah, I think, you know, it's a learning curve for anybody, particularly in this Airbnb space. So there's certainly a requirement for licensing and regulation. I don't know if limiting the number of nights an Airbnb unit can be used per year is the answer, because what it does is it adds this medium-term rental dynamic to the market, which can also then outprice residents. I don't necessarily know that's going to be the answer, but it does certainly need regulation and licensing. My biggest concern with this then becomes, in South Africa in particular, is an over-regulation and sort of a stunting of the market. Because tourism and Airbnb does bring so much to the city, we've also got to consider the counterbalance to over-regulation.
Talking of regulation, there are proposals, I understand, to cap the number of days a property could be rented out each year. That might break the investment model for many Airbnb landlords, but again, it will be difficult to police or regulate, surely.
Yeah, so again, policing regulation in South Africa, regulation is great, but the policing of it and the ability to hold people accountable is definitely falls short in the city and in Cape Town, in South Africa in particular. But if they do bring those regulations in place, we will break the investment model and we will see a return to the long-term market and the sales market of many, many units, which will then impact capital values and pricing.
What's the consequence, talking about pricing and capital value, if the city forces short-term rentals to pay commercial municipal rates?
So I think what will happen actually is less about the impact directly or in the short term. You're going to have people knee-jerk and sell properties also. We will see an immediate sell-off and also return to long-term market. But what will start happening is people, Airbnb investors, will start passing that increase in rates into the nightly rates. So what we'll see a broad increase of nightly rates on the short-term market and not really a rectification of the long-term market or pricing.
There's a lot of distress and anger here. Body corporates, as I understand it, are trying at least to ban short-term letting because of security and disruption concerns, and that I understand. But I wonder if the industry has underestimated, Grant, how much resentment this model is creating among permanent residents. Do you have any sense?
Yeah, so I think we're seeing definitely where there are a lot complexes that are largely resident-based, there's definitely is pushback and security concerns. But then when we're seeing these buildings move into more tenanted properties and the ratio of tenants increases, some of those landlords and resident owners that were complaining are now looking at the Airbnb model as an opportunity to make more money out of their units. So it's really a balancing act of circumstance and timing. But, you know, you do understand, again, body corporate concerns around security in particular. But I think there can be steps they can take versus banning it outright, which would impact property prices. And we've seen cases like that where short-term has been banned in units where it severely impacts the property price of that complex compared to their neighbors. They can put other steps in place and implement other security measures to mitigate their concerns.
So it comes down to whether residential housing primarily should serve tourists with deep pockets or people who live and work in Cape Town. And there's no easy answer here.
There really isn't an easy answer. I think the investment model works in certain circumstances. And obviously, again, residents do have the right to have access to housing, at least for employment and location. So it's a really tough balancing act the city has to play.
Grant Smee, thank you very much indeed. Chief Executive Officer, Only Realty.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
South Africa's households may finally be getting a little bit of breathing room, but I think it's fair to say the pressure is far from over. The latest Altron FinTech Household Resilience Index shows a modest improvement in financial resilience during 2025. That, I guess, was helped by lower interest rates largely, but the gains are small. In fact, since the interest rate hiking cycle began in 2021, household financial resilience has increased by less than 1% a year. That is troubling. Well, let's get more details now. I'm in conversation with Johan Galatly, who's Managing Director at Altron FinTech. Johan, thanks for joining us. Let's start with that headline. The index has improved slightly, but by less than 1% a year since that rate hiking cycle began. Is the reality that South African households are actually getting poorer in real terms and in real time?
Thank you, Jeremy, and I appreciate hosting me. So that's really, really great. Jeremy, yes, what we have started off with Dr. Roelof Botha is we started this project to see how resilient the households in South Africa really are and what is the indicators that drive how resilient they are. So we identified 20 indicators in the index and we're monitoring these index. We've based the index on 2014 stats, and that's when we started basing the numbers. And what was surprising, Jeremy, from your introduction, is how fast the reaction is from when you see the change in interest rates in the resilience of the households. I mean, we were very surprised to see that inertia is virtually perhaps a quarter, if you stretch it. But the households are extremely under pressure because of the interest rates. I mean, if you go back to COVID, when they dropped the interest rates, I think, by 4 to 7%, if I'm not mistaken, we saw the index shoot through the roof. I mean, the households have more disposable income in their wallets. They could they invest in their households, they improved their households, and they could invest in their families. So that was, for us, a very encouraging trend. And if you look at the 20 indexes, it is not that our our households in the country are irresponsible in terms of how they spend their disposable income. They are really prudent in terms of how they go about spending their money. So for us, it is not that our interest rates are demandful. You know, it's not demand driven. We really look after our disposable income well, and that was a very encouraging from the index. And now we see that direct correlation again with the latest, I think 3 or 4 drops last year. I mean, there's a slight increase in the index towards the fourth quarter of last calendar year. So yeah, so we see a direct correlation in terms of the health of the households in the country versus the interest rate. So that's encouraging for us.
Johan, one of the striking trends in your data is the surge in insurance policy surrenders and annuity withdrawals. Yeah. Let me ask you this. Are households effectively raiding their long-term savings just to survive right now?
Spot on, Jeremy, spot on. So what happens is you look at your spend and the commitments that you've made, and then you prioritize. I mean, you're going to look after your family, and you're going to survive as a family. And then you go through all your expenses that you have on a monthly basis, and then you de-risk those. And you look at the risks of each of those if you don't spend that money. And that's how households are prudently looking at their spend per month. So it's not that they're going out and buying flat screen televisions or a new fridge or something like that. It's really going after a serious interrogation of their spend. And you would find those two items are at the lower risk end for them. So they can defer that. They can start up again in a few months from now, and then they can continue. But the households are looking at their wallets, and they're looking at their wallets with concern. And it is the real on the ground feeling that we're getting from running our index and compiling.
I mean, back to that word resilience. What I find particularly worrying, though, is the two-pot retirement system did inject a degree of liquidity into households. But, Johan, and I think you'll agree with me, at the cost of future retirement savings. And the conclusion I draw is that we're simply borrowing from tomorrow to pay for the financial pressure that we're feeling today. And that is a very, very worrying trend.
Jeremy, I can understand that the policymakers and the regulators wanted to give people some resilience in terms of how they see their futures happening. But your assertion is 100% correct, and that's my personal opinion as well. I think that's not the way to go. We should rather look at other levers that we can pull in the country. And I am one that that supports the narrative of if we drop our interest rates by 2 to 3% in the next 2 to 3, 4 quarters, we wouldn't recognize this country. I mean, the corporates and enterprises are sitting on balance sheets that goes into the trillions of rands, and that uncertainty of how we're going to manage the consumer in the country. And how are we going to give some relief to the consumer in the country to start investing in the households? We will get the enterprises and the large corporates to start investing in the country. But we're not getting to that point where we realize that our economy is not structured like the rest of the economy in the world. And I'm not saying that we should be irresponsible and it should be a measured view of it. But take into account the real life situations of a large portion of our economy, which is the informal economy. And I understand that the Stats SA has got a measurement or a metric, and therefore how they add the informal economy to Stats SA results. But I'm not too sure if that's measured correctly. I mean, we had the Capitec CEO come under some serious criticism for his comments on the size of the informal economy. We saw the ShopRite Checkers report out this morning, and they're measuring differently, and they've got different stats to what is being used for determining what the real inflation is. So we need to put our heads together, Jeremy. For me, it's we need to get private enterprise, the treasury, the finance sector, and some kind of index from the informal economy, and how we measure and how we add that to making our decisions in the country. And that's really of the utmost importance.
That's the way forward. And let me just put a final question to you, just back to the data if I can, and this is something that impacts all of our listeners, and that's real salaries in the private sector, Jan, if I read this correctly, have actually edged lower. It would suggest to me that inflation is still quietly eroding purchasing power in spite of the fact that it has come down?
Sure, Jeremy. If you have a look at the real actual numbers, what goes into the back pockets of our employees in the country, it is eating at it slowly. So we don't have new employees entering the formal and the informal sector. So it is challenging for the people to say, okay, we've got an increase in employment of 10 or whatever percent, because if that happens, there will be more disposable income and the indirect economies will benefit from that. And if that benefits, we have the knock-on effect of people investing again in the economies because they see some long-term sustainable growth. And that's what we're on about, because, you know, the corporates of Africa are sitting around and saying, dudes, how do we go about employing more people if we don't have some certainty? And the certainty is what big business is all about. I mean, and that's what we're advocating.
Right.
So I think the SARB is doing an excellent job of how they want to create financial inclusion in the national payment system. And the Treasury have managed our finances properly. I mean, South Africa was so protected and shielded from the 2008 crisis that we didn't actually feel that. So the uncertainty in the world is where, we as South Africans need to have a measured view on what's going to happen with the fuel price. How is that going to inject more inflation,
Johan?
And what the effect's going to be in the back pocket.
I'm going to leave it there. Thank you very much indeed for that thorough assessment. Johan Galatly, Managing Director at Altron FinTech.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, South Africa, I read, could be on the verge of building an entirely new agricultural export industry, and it could be potentially worth billions of rands. Growers and investors believe the country's arid Northern Cape climate could support a major pistachio sector with ambitions to produce as much as 60,000 tons a year and capture as much as 8% of the global market. Now, I understand the opportunity exists because nearly all pistachios are currently produced in just a handful of Northern Hemisphere countries. Now, that leaves a valuable counter-seasonal supply gap that Southern Hemisphere producers like South Africa could fill. But I think that turning pistachios into a serious export industry is going to require a patient capital, probably large-scale orchards, and a coordinated agricultural push. But I'm not the expert here. Let me talk to David Miller from Karoo Pistachios. David, a very warm welcome to you. I can confidently say this is the first time we've ever spoken about pistachio nuts on this program. It's a big claim you're making. How could the industry realistically become so successful in South Africa?
Hi, Jeremy. Yeah, thanks for the opportunity and thanks for having me and talking the first time about pistachios. I think it leans itself towards a lot of puns.
It does,
but,
indeed.
I think the potential for us is, as you mentioned, that global pistachio production is concentrated in four Northern Hemisphere countries, and many of those regions face water constraints, climate pressures, or political risks. And that opens up a clear opportunity for us to enter into this market. And if you look at the pistachio market as a whole on a global scale, it basically summarizes as a constrained supply and growing demand. And we've proven that the Northern Cape is an ideal area to grow a high-quality premium pistachio nut.
David, explain to me how established or how settled the industry is in South Africa right now, or are you starting with essentially a clean slate here?
It's a bit of a counterintuitive answer in the sense that the industry is really small hectares-wise. There's only about 10 hectares producing orchards, which we kind of view as trial sites or pilot sites of proof of concept. And there's about 200 to 300 newly established hectares right now. But what makes it so counterintuitive is that even though the industry is small, our knowledge and experience is far surpasses a lot of industries in South Africa that's actually already much larger. So we have about a 20-30 year experience with pistachios, during which we learned most of its unique kind of peculiarities or challenges, which we've kind of overcome and found the answer. So in a sense, it's a new industry, but it's almost like a young person with an old soul, if you can put it like that.
That's a very nice way of putting it. David, answer this question for me. And you're talking to someone who, I enjoy a good salted pistachio. Sometimes I hate it when I get one of the nuts and I can't open it, but that's my problem, not yours. How easy or how difficult is it as a crop to farm?
Pistachios is what Churchill said. It's enigma within a riddle within a mystery. And it has some really unique kind of challenges, which took us quite a while to kind of figure out. And now I think we're at a place where we kind of understand it. And we've proven that we can make it work, and we get high quality, high volume yields in South Africa, the Karoo, compared to the best of the world. But it has almost like, if you get it right, it works. If you don't, you miss it. It's kind of a bit of a diva crop, but quite a while to figure it out. But we now know how.
Let's talk a little bit about the numbers. I think I quoted you correctly in saying potentially 16,000 tons of production. That would equate to around 8% of the global market, obviously, if you get this right. Economically, what would that be worth? And maybe just reflect on the jobs potential.
So economically, it's probably about 2 to 3 billion rand export industry, depending on the value add component. But we're also looking at product beneficiation. And currently, if you look at the jobs and economic growth and the impact on the promise and opportunity that it holds for the Northern Cape, is currently the Northern Cape is farmed corn, wheat, and mostly row crops. So if you take that and you convert that to pistachios, you 4x your revenue, your 8x your profitability, and your jobs is about a 30x. So currently corn and wheat or row crops employ about one person for every 50 to 60 hectares farm. But if you take that over to pistachios, it almost become a one-on-one. So you really have the opportunity here to create at least 2,000 to 3,000 jobs in the Northern Cape in the next 2 to 3 years, which doesn't sound like a lot, but I think the Northern Cape only employs like 40,000 people. So it's quite a significant numbers in terms of the Northern Cape.
And beyond just the pure farming, obviously there is downstream infrastructure build. So I'm thinking of processing, logistics and export channels. You've got to get that right in order to make this a global industry, right?
Exactly, yeah. So those were directly employed numbers that I quoted. But as soon as you go downstream, probably has a 3 to 4x factor. And the nice thing about pistachios is that we're building the complete value chain within the Northern Cape. So processing, product beneficiation, packaging, exporting. And that really holds a great opportunity for the Northern Cape.
Obviously, like everything in life, it comes down to money, doesn't it? You've said one of the biggest challenges is access to the right kind of funding. Why would traditional agricultural finance models struggle with a perennial crop?
Oh, there's often a disconnect between traditional funding models and the biological realities of a perennial crop. And one of the biggest constraints in South African agriculture is access to appropriately structured capital. And I think one of the key reasons why we've been so successful in this project is that we have a capital partnership with Fed Group, which were innovative and creative enough to adopt a patient capital approach, which they align with the maturation cycles of pistachio. So the issue here isn't balance sheet. Like the underlying assets is there. It isn't profitability. Pistachios run at a gross margin of 75%. It literally is a cash flow issue. And I think usually why industries like this takes 80 to 100 years to establish is most farmers finance that out of pocket. And because now capital partners such as Fed Group on board, it will allow us to take that and do it within 20 years.
David Miller, fascinating story and the very best of luck. Enjoyed talking to you from Karoo Pistachios. And that's our program for today and, in fact, for the week. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. We are here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.